Hi, everybody. Thanks for being here and for listening to my podcast. If you've listened to the last couple episodes, you know I've been experimenting a bit with the form of the show. I've been trying to have more conversations with other people, which I find a bit easier than doing the show by myself. And honestly, it's also more enjoyable for me to talk to other people, which maybe because of my age, I seem to be doing less than I'd like to these days. So in today's episode, I talked to my good friend Sabri Sundos, who I've known as Sam for something crazy like 30 years now. We grew up together in suburban San Diego, and in high school and in college, we became quite close over our shared love of music. At that time, we were a part of a punk or post-punk or indie music scene, as we get into a bit during our conversation. And we both live in New York now, so we've stayed pretty close ever since then. Anyway, Sam has blossomed into quite the visual artist. He's constantly showing his work in New York. I went to a show he did recently in LA. So give him a follow on Instagram if you want to check out some of his work. In fact, I'd say scrolling his Instagram would make a sort of good B-roll for our conversation. He's got a lot of his paintings there and also some of his tatriz pieces, which is a traditional Palestinian weaving technique. He also teaches workshops on tatriz, which tend to sell like hotcakes, so sign up for one of those if you're interested. And finally, check out his book, which just came out and is really fantastic. It's called Generations Removed, Bloom, and was released by Adventures LTD. So check that out, and please enjoy my conversation with Sabri. What's up, dude?
Not much. How are you?
I'm good.
I think you should have lit your Hanukkah candles.
Oh, yeah.
I did this.
Yeah. Should we light them up? Do you have a lighter?
Yeah, I do.
I was trying to find chocolate to give to your daughter, but I couldn't find any in my neighborhood.
Is this Sesame special kind of chocolate?
Well, the Jewish chocolate, the coins.
Oh. Coins?
You know how much we like the
chocolate
coins.
Is the Jewish chocolate. I feel like sometimes...
it's a little too on the nose.
It's like, sometimes. What? Yeah, and...
yeah, it's like you play the game where you try to, the children try to...
find the coins?
Yeah, it's like...
does it have to do with, does Hanukkah have to do with, like, money? No.
No.
No, it's just like...
no, that's the thing.
It's about petroleum, right, or something?
Yeah, it's about oil. Well, yeah. It's not that kind of oil, but yeah, it is funny enough about oil, which I also hadn't thought about until just now. I'm going to try to... it's about defeating the, I believe, the... Assyrians.
The Ottomans? That's before the Ottomans.
Before the Ottomans, when they destroyed the first... so you got to light this candle first.
But don't you have to say the thing?
Yeah, but first...
oh, you first you light that.
Then you
oh, because we're on the second night.
Yeah, oh shit.
You need scissors?
Yeah, I might need scissors. Cut that bitch. This one is called the... oh, I forget what it's called. The Afikoman is the matzah. See, then you go...
so it's not matzah every night.
I don't remember the beginning, but you get the idea. And I guess the Maccabees, before they started a super violent soccer hooligan club.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's the name of the...
yeah, it comes from... the like this militia, like a Jewish army that was like holed up in the destroyed temple. Like they not the I think Assyrians, maybe it was the Romans. I'd have to go back and read, but some enemy of the Jewish people destroyed the first temple.
Right.
And then the Maccabees and a bunch of other people were like in the rubble.
Mm.
And it was dark in there and they had oil to light lamps, but they only had enough oil for one night.
Right.
And then the miracle is that it lasted for 8 nights.
And then they got out.
Yeah, I forget what happens after that. They probably fucked some shit up if I had to guess. But they got out of there.
Prevailed.
They got out of there and they prevailed. I've been thinking a lot about your book, and I said this to you before, but like one of the things I really enjoy about your book is... like being your friend for as long as we've been friends the book does a good job of sort of retracing your evolution as a visual artist, you know? And for me, it's like extra interesting or rewarding, or sort of like, it makes me proud to see that evolution, in part because I also remember your evolution like previous to your visual art practice. And your entry point into art, which, like, in my reckoning, came in the form of music, right? And being into music that was, like, alternative or, like, it was, whatever, punk or post-punk or somehow inspired by or derivative of punk. And also simple at times, like, in their construct compared to, like, other forms of music, right? Like, if you compare it to, like, jazz or classical music or even, like, other types of rock that, that we're not as into. So I wanted to ask you about that. Like, do you, how do you think about that chapter of your life and what it was that first interested you in music? And if you see those same interests reflected in your earliest delving in visual art?
I think with music, it was like, it was just the thing that made the most sense to me. Even when I was younger, it was like, I want to be Michael Jackson, right? Or something. And like, you know what I mean? Like, I want to, that's what a musician looked like. But then like, you're like, you can't be that. That's crazy. But as you get older and you find your own music, you start hanging out with your friends. You're like, oh wait, but there's these guys in like jeans that just get up and pick up a guitar and it's like $100 guitar. And I can just like figure out how the Beatles wrote a song and I'll just learn that. I mean, it sounds like a lot of work when I say it, but like the entry point is way low, right? So like I can convince my parents to get me a guitar, then I can hang out with my friends who know how to play guitar and they'll show me how to play these songs and I want to hang out with them. So like, that's what I'm going to do. Right. So there's just like, and there was no intention of anything of like money making. It was like, I thought we would just all be, if we were all broke together, then we're not broke. So that was just an easy way for me to be like, it was just doing the, it was the doing it part that I think the music was for me, because I don't think I never, I ever really learned who I was talking to when I was playing music. I was kind of searching for who my audience was and what I really wanted to say and how I could say it smart. Whereas in something about the visual arts, to me, like eliminated a factor of using words or like a convincing of anything. It was just like, I'm going to draw this picture and if it translates or makes you feel something, great. And I don't have to like explain myself too much until eventually you do, but like I feel like the music part, the entry point for me was just like, this is easy ish you know, like this is like, okay, you learn, you put a song together, you hopefully get a show, and then you kind of just start doing it, you know.
But what about like, you were talking about who you're talking to and who you're playing music with and the substance of it, like in my reckoning, right, a lot of it was like kind of, you know, pretty typical, like the same shit I was into at the same time, like kind of angsty stuff, love, relationships or whatever, like what our idea of like what relationships were, maybe a little bit of like fuck you dad, like not your dad, but just like the figurative dad. And I guess that's what I'm sort of getting at is like, I see in your visual art this evolution where it's like something that is personal and is of that sort of like genre of art that's about like those sort of angst of like a young person, you know, love or like your self perception or whatever, you know? And then it's evolved, like it's evolved in part because of like your evolution as an artist, but also because of the world around you has like changed and you have like responded to those things. And now I feel like your art practice has sort of like, you've in a way like reconnected with like a past that in some way or another, when you were younger, you like had been rebelling against, the way we all were rebelling against our upbringing or our, you know, family or whatever.
I think I'm just having more fun. Like, and I hate this because a lot of my songs when I was young was like, I want to have fun. I want fun. Like a bunch of like, you know, just like child, like punk kind of wannabe stuff. But like, I think I'm actually like, I don't think I really enjoyed myself during the time of making music. Like I liked, I had a really good time, but I was never like happy with anything I was doing. Like I was like, the show isn't good enough. And there was a lot of like looking at my friends being like, oh, I wanted to like, why are they on tour? Why aren't I on tour and stuff like that? Whereas in like, now I'm just like really, I think it's because I'm older and I have like a, I have a point of view more than I think I did. That more specific point of view than like, we aren't just singing about like these love songs or like, fuck the man or whatever the shit is. Like, it's like a very specific ideologies that I'm going to put as simply as possible.
Yeah.
With the hopes that one day I can like get them across on like a white canvas. Like, I think that's like the dream of like an artist is to do the very little, very least and get
well, that your... seems to be a recurring theme.
But like, it's, yeah, I think it just comes out once you're more comfortable as an artist and you have time to do that. When I didn't,
yeah,
you know, I just like had time to play. I gave myself time to play around.
Yeah.
But there is a reversion back to like being a child though. And like, as I know, as corny as that sounds, there is this like going back to just like, all right, I can't paint the best nose. Like, you know, like I can't paint you an apple the way the apple looks.
Sure.
Or I'm not trying to do that, you know? So like, and I don't care if it's not that. So there's this ethos of going back to like a punk DIY thing where maybe I'm going to bar chord my way through a song.
Yeah.
You know?
But I guess in the way that like drinking and smoking weed and partying, which were all like parts of the, parts of our like evolution as people and... Who knows whether or not that was... I mean, I guess it was connected.
I thought that was the key to success, to be honest. You're like, well, Jim Morrison... You know, I don't think... Well, because you read his book and it's like, oh, Toni Morrison wrote... Or maybe... I think it was Toni Morrison.
Maybe it was
like,
Jim Morrison. Maybe it was Toni Morrison.
Maybe, yeah. One of the Morrisons was waking up super early, making breakfast for their family, driving their kids to school, and then like working in a hotel room until 3 and then picking up their kids and then like making dinner. I'm like... Oh, I wish I knew that was a way to become like a respectable artist instead of like the other Morrison. I don't know which one it was, is walking on rooftops, drinking Jack Daniels and like being a destructive person.
That was Tony. That was Tony.
That was Tony. But I think, I mean, not to deny either one. I think, I mean, those times where I definitely learned a lot about myself.
Right. So but I guess like what I was trying to, I don't know, maybe this is like, a hypothesis that only exists in my mind and isn't a reflection of reality, but your like reconnection with your identity as like a Arab and as a Palestinian is like a big part of the evolution of your art practice. That is, I guess, what I'm like getting at is like there was a rebellion or an angst like in your music and in your early visual art.
Yeah,
that maybe also had to do with that. It was a youthful sort of rebellion, but it was a rebellion against things you found like constraining or oppressive or whatever, right?
Which when you're young is your identity. Like, you know, it's like you're trying to fit in. And I'm like, I just want to like surf and skate with these white dudes. And like, why can't I do that?
Yeah.
So I'm just going to do my best to do that.
Yeah.
But then now I'm like, I'm never going to fit in that room.
Yeah.
And those people like me. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm just going to do my own thing. Even with like my name, like going by Subri now instead of like Sam. Like all my homie, like all my old friends still call me Sam. And I'm fine. Like, it's not like a pronoun thing. It's just straight up. I'm like, well, now if I'm speaking up about all this stuff and I'm being honest and I'm trying to reclaim this like pride in myself and trying to be a better example, then you don't call me Subri. Like, why am I trying to hide and be like Sam?
Right.
You know, so it's, it's weird.
Starting over really with more pride. I find that really cool because it's like the, like your reconnection with, Tatriz is like, it's like you came full circle. It's like you're doing something that is, like simple in its, practice and it's very like handmade, you know, it's very like anti-commercial as you, as you've like explained. And, but at the same time, it is like a part of this like tradition that's like a part of your history, like your own personal and family history.
Yeah.
That like, you know, the younger Sam.
Yeah, yeah.
Would probably like roll his eyes at or something. And now you're like embracing it and leaning into it. I just think that's cool.
Yeah. It's like, you know, and like, would you ever go back and redo it? And you're like, yeah, I would with like the information that I have now.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm doing that with my art practice. Like, I'm like, okay. This is a second go at like an art practice. And I'm like, all right, cool. You're going to be proud of who you are.
Yeah.
You're going to know your shit.
Yeah.
You're going to not like overthink it. Of course, like every day you're like fighting, but like, yeah, I think there's just a confidence that you get when you're older, but I don't think it would be there without the time doing music. It all feeds into itself, I guess, really, honestly.
So. Yeah, it's like I see it like you exercised and developed this muscle of like
doing,
expressing making, things, yeah. And maybe you were like just expressing the things that you had on your mind at that time.
Yeah.
And now that you're like a more evolved person, you're like expressing things that are really more profound and interesting, you know?
Mm, thanks.
But yeah, that's like you exercise the muscle with something that was like angsty and more like personal, and now it's something more like political,
more full, yeah,
you know,
in more that, of a full picture, totally,
yeah.
But also just help you practice getting things done, like finishing something.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a huge thing that is a big part of being an artist,
yeah,
which I think I'm glad I did. Like, I started young,
right?
You know, like people get really excited about ideas and then put them on the shelf,
sure, yeah. That's so, why it's like kind of silly to look back and like,
right, and be like, oh, I'm starting. I mean, I don't think, yeah, it all feeds into each
Luckily,
other.
Luckily, a lot of the shit I did when we were that age is not on the internet, and like, I know some of it's lost, and I'm kind of grateful.
But
I'm
that stuff was fun. I know, but that was those shows were. I mean, I still remember those like coffee shop Santa Barbara shows.
Yeah,
those were dope.
The Biko House,
and it always felt like it was just a thing we did in the night, and just like moved on. It was like we'd be all hanging out in your house.
Yeah.
Like, oh, we have a show in 20 minutes. We drive to downtown Santa Barbara. We'd all do the, you guys would do the show, and then we just like pack up and either go get like a burrito or go
like
to
hot,
a party.
Hot heat, like crowd surfed in my living room.
Yeah, that was a crazy. I mean, that's like a. We had a crazy time. I would leave my school for a week and just hang out with you guys. Right. Like, that's crazy. That's what one of the Morrisons would have definitely done.
Definitely. Probably Tony. All right, should we listen to some of these New Yorker clips?
Yeah.
Let's listen to these goobers from the New Yorker. So as I was saying, before the election in 2024, last year, they did like a live podcast, and they had one of their favorite guests, this historian named Michael Beschloss, and they're sort of talking about the stakes of that election, the election Donald Trump won. But here they are talking, well, Michael Beschloss talking about the stakes of that election a few days before it took place.
If Kamala Harris is elected, I mean, I can tell you already, and I think you all can too. Thank you for the honor of asking, but I would ask Evan, and I think we'd probably say the same thing, which is that it shows that the resistance to dictatorship in American history, reports of its death were premature. And that the DNA of America going all the way back to 1776 and before then was, if there's any purpose we've got, it is resistance to being controlled by authoritarianism.
Interesting. Interesting stakes making, right? Like, if Harris wins, it will mean that the United States rejected and resisted against authoritarianism. So what should we make of the fact that that didn't pan out to be true?
I just love it depends on the word of like resistance and like the reconstructing of what the American independence was of like this. We don't want a king. We want everyone to be equal, which was bullshit.
Right. Yeah.
The people who are voting for Trump are resisting what they imagine is establishment politics.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Those who voted for Kamala are resisting, I guess, autocracy.
Yeah.
So it's all just kind of, I don't know what we're doing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't know what any of this, I mean, it's obviously, it's this, I mean, we're talking about this election again. It's like the people, I don't know. It was a failure on everyone's part.
Well, the reason why I decided to revisit that episode of that podcast is because now, this week, they put out a new episode that is a look back at like 2025, right? It's like the end of the year, so everyone's doing their recaps.
Of course.
And they did this episode this week. We're going to hear some clips from that show where they're like talking about what surprised them and what they learned from Donald Trump being president for a year. So I thought it'd be interesting
to hear that.
Go back and hear them sort of like set up these stakes, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Because like an obsession of mine and like an obsession of like my show, the New Yorker political scene, has been that like American exceptionalism, like to anyone with like more than a dozen brain cells is just nonsense. It's like believing in Santa Claus or fucking thinking that like Disneyland is like a real city in America or something.
Which is fun at the beginning.
It's fun, yeah. And it's like, I guess it's like sort of comforting to like think that, just like it's comforting to think that like to watch like the Avengers or something, you know what I mean? Like there's people who are just like want to turn their critical thinking brain off and just let the good vibes like wash over them that way.
Me too, brother.
Yeah. Sometimes you need a little fucking.
I was thinking about that. Like, I forgot what I was watching. Watching some movie. You know, you throw in like an old movie, just like a warm blanket.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, it was The Hangover. I'm like embarrassed to say it. But, you know, like, it's just a bad. I mean, it's horrible. Like, from like the language they use to just the content. You're like,
yeah.
I looked at Chris and I was like, remember how like dumb we were? Like, yeah. As a society where we were like, this is fine.
Yeah.
This is good. And I'm laughing and I'm like, you know, it was just like, we were so, like, I mean, I'm not going to speak for everybody, but there's a time where just that blanket of just ignorance was cozy and nice. So I get why people want to stay in it.
Yeah, like 3-4 years ago. So like, yeah, that was Michael Beschloss in 2024. And so let's see what the other hosts of the political scene were saying about what lessons we should take away from the election if Donald Trump were to win.
No, this is an incredibly nerve-wracking time. We, as anybody who listens to the podcast knows, we go back and forth arguing with each other to go over the cliff or come back above the cliff. There's some hope, maybe. I'm hoping women come through on this particular election. But I think, and the other thing that's worrying me as someone who's written a number of books with the word dark in the title is that win or lose, what does it say about this country?
And so, like, I just think that's my favorite topic on podcasts like The New Yorker is, like, their failure to recognize that they're living in, like, a Disneyland, you know?
Right.
Like, well, what? And as if, like, Donald Trump winning by like 4 or 5% of the country thinks X instead of Y, then who we are as a country fundamentally is like somehow diametrically opposed, you know? Yeah. I find that to be really fun.
And what was being said about our country at the time anyway?
Right? Well, that's
we were not in good shape.
Well, like that's what's funny. That's what's funny to me about this shit is like, these people just exist in some. And here's the crazy thing. Susan Glasser, like, lived in Russia for a long time. Evan Osnos lived in China. He, like, wrote a whole book about China. These are people who have, like, lived in other parts of the world, but somehow they go through life and the world, regardless of where they are geographically, thinking that America is this, like, exceptional country that's an exemplar, an example of democracy and freedom, and that we have like the world's greatest political system and all this bullshit, you know?
Yeah.
And they're never, well, my question, I remember listening to that episode, was like, if Donald Trump wins, then what? Are they gonna turn into, is that gonna blackpill them, essentially, you know?
In the eyes of Donald?
Yeah, like, are they, so they're saying, like, if Donald Trump wins the election, which he did,
right,
then it will mean that we've, like, chose authoritarianism over freedom and democracy, or what will it say about the country if Donald Trump wins, is, like, the question that Jane Mayer is asking. So here's Jane Mayer, like, a year later in this week's episode. Okay. Here's one of the things she says has surprised her.
I imagined there would be major pushback from the American public, from civil society, from all sectors, and it's not our culture to have an authoritarian kind of powerful strongman. At least in my years of my life, I hadn't seen it, and I've seen it abroad and didn't think it would take here. I've been really surprised at how quickly the places that I thought would resist folded instead.
And she's like talking really about, like, you know, Columbia University and the Supreme Court and these like huge law firms that are paying out these settlements to Donald Trump and media institutions that have like caved in and given Donald Trump these huge settlements to his lawsuits.
Yeah. Is she right?
What do you mean?
Did I just agree with her?
Yeah. That happens. It happens.
Usually my brain turns off when I hear that kind of cadence and that voice where I'm just like, I don't care.
Well,
but I think that was, wow, okay.
Yeah, I mean, she's right. But the thing is, like, at the very beginning of what she says there is, like, I was surprised.
Right. Well, I mean, that's the funny part is that American culture was never about the strongman. I'm like, our whole fucking thing is built on the strongman. Like, that's who we are, the superpower in the world. Like, Paul Bunyan, fucking Johnny Appleseed, one man changes, you know what I mean? Like
George W. Bush.
I mean, it's just so funny.
But that, I mean, I guess that's kind of what I find funny. And it's one of the reasons why I like this show, like listening to the New Yorker political scene. It's like, they're smart people. They're not stupid, but they're stupid in their souls, you know?
They're just out of touch, right? Like, it's the same thing when we're all, you listen to like a Fran Lebowitz talk and you're like, I've never, whatever. You're like, oh, you just haven't spoken to a normal person in 40 years.
Yeah. And like,
there's a tax bracket you haven't dipped below.
It's like, as smart as they are, I guess what I enjoy is like when they walk right up to the cusp, they're like, if Donald Trump wins this election, it will mean X, Y, and Z about this country, you know? And then that happens and they're like, I was shocked that like this, that, and the other. And you're like, didn't you just say that if Donald Trump were to win, then like it will have meant that the United States is like, just like everywhere else in the world, basically.
Yeah, right.
Here's one from Susan Glasser.
Help us to understand the other ways in which you see what's happening with Trump as an outlier to American history versus where you see the continuities. What has shocked you in terms of the twists of history here? Or is it just that we've maybe come to the death of American exceptionalism and it turns out that we're as susceptible to a strong man as any other country?
Ding, 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 ding. That's my point. It's like sometimes they're right, you know? They even asked the question. And but that was 2024. That was 2024.
Oh, that was?
Yeah.
But they don't acknowledge, they're still lost in the idea that there was a time where America was an exceptional place.
Yes.
Do you know what I'm saying? That's where, like, you guys are starting from the wrong point. You know?
Right, yeah.
Like, Reagan, Truman is a fucking idiot. You know what I mean? Like, we've been led by like really bad people in this country that have done, and not only the leaders, but like Kissinger, like people below the guy.
Sure.
That I'm like, where is this like, and they're smart, which leads me to believe that like they're really out of touch or they've just like lied to themselves in order to like live in this country without question, you know?
I used to always say like the QAnon people they're close to being right insofar as they're, as it turns out, is or was, probably is, like a cabal of, you know, wealthy pedophiles.
Well, let's wait until the files are released.
Sure,
we gotta make sure.
We gotta verify. Yeah. But, like, whether it's, you know, Jeffrey Epstein or others like him or whatever, like, clearly they were right about that instinct. Like, they had this, like, intuitive sense that they were being manipulated and that the powerful were doing like really nefarious things behind closed doors. They were obviously wrong about like, well, obviously they're gonna like abuse children on a private island in the Caribbean, not in the basement of a pizza parlor. Yeah. Like that's where they were like off. And it's like these people, you know, like they believe they have a similar amount of delusion.
Uh-huh.
You know? Like they're like perceptive to some signals, they're perceptive to like disturbance in the force, but they seemingly are like unable to turn the page and just go like, okay, America isn't really truly a democracy at all. It's certainly not exceptional. Like it's certainly not. There's terrible fundamental flaws with the founding of the country and the way it's organized politically. That doesn't mean I hate this country. It doesn't mean I like. I'm not a patriot or whatever like nonsense anyone would like say hearing me say this, but that's just being like a realistic person who uses their brain critically, you know? That's
it's like walking into your apartment and be like, this place is a mess.
Yeah.
Like
it
what
stinks
the fuck
in here. You know, but seemingly these people are like not able to like recognize that about this country. And I find that really kind of fascinating. Let's hear one more of these clips.
I think Democrats on some level actually didn't take their own rhetoric about an existential threat to our institutions seriously enough, because they clearly weren't prepared for it when it happened.
Dude, they're also missing the point of what was happening during this fucking election. At no point were people voting. People I were talking, which maybe is more of a bubble, but we weren't. That election was not about saving democracy.
Right.
It was about like Democrats stand up for what's right and stand up against this guy that you've been like letting push fucking this genocide further. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, and she and Kamala refused to do that.
Yeah.
So like, cool, we're gonna let it burn in my in my world.
Sure. Yeah.
And for me to be like, she's like, these Democrats, and then that's when I'm like, yeah, I guess I'm not a Democrat.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And so I'm not part of that party anymore. Like, you know, I'm not part of that like scene. But then that scene's nothing without the majority of people who protest vote, who, like, you know, like withheld their vote or whatever.
Well, who knows even what that scene is now?
That's what I'm saying. It's a mess. But they also just aren't. They're ignoring. They're completely just blind to the entire left side. Like the vision scope, and they're just like focused on what's in front of them, and then everything to the right. You know what I mean? I'm like, there's a whole population that you aren't looking at. So it's just. Diminishes that conversation for me to be a part of, you know what I mean? Because then you just have to, like, start in. But I don't know. They're writing for The New Yorker, and I'm embroidering flowers.
Yeah, well, you know, they're each their own sort of fantastical pursuits. You're each, like, somehow representing things in the world.
We've all got blinders
in a way, you know?
Yeah, but I think it's still lost, and that's not the scary part. I mean, it is scary because I am still living in the world where Trump is allowed to be Trump, so it is frustrating to see that there is nothing up to really fight against him, but, like, it's scary to think that we're approaching another election soon, and whether it's not Trump, it's, like, what are you going to put up against him, like Newsom?
Well, Harris is saying
Harris is like still the new, like, she does. She's like, fucking Hillary, chill. I got this next fucking.
It's so funny. Like,
it's you, and nothing has changed. You know what I mean? Harris is still getting up at book talks, like giving everybody a piece of her mind. You're like, shut up. Like, say the right thing and just keep it moving. Like,
One thing I have enjoyed, or that's been sort of reassuring to me, is, like, some of these people have done book tours, like, Jean-Pierre, the...
that was insane.
And it's kind of interesting to watch them. This is a comms professional. Like, this is a person whose whole career was premised on, like, effectively communicating with the public and sort of, like, understanding where the public is on things and understanding where she is on things and having to sort of meet them somewhere.
Yeah.
And then she puts out this book, and everyone, like, Morning Joe, like, people who you would not expect are just, like, shitting on her and shitting on the book. And she was so caught off guard. Like, she didn't see that coming, you know?
Yeah.
That was kind of reassuring to me, because I was like, oh, even these fucking Dems who are just...
Well, the thing is, Biden, like, burned everybody, it seemed like.
Yeah, I guess, like,
even when you lose Tapper, you're, like, gone.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
I think everyone was just ready to just, like, this guy fucked us.
Yeah.
For whatever reasons they thought they fucked, you know?
Yeah, but you, like, could see a world where she puts out that book and is like, here's what I learned, is like a...
I think in a world where Kamala wins.
In a world where Kamala wins, is the world,
like, that's
where,
the world where
she's like, I'm a queer BIPOC woman, like, and da-da-da-da-da, and this was my experience in the White House.
And look what, you know, it opened the door for, I mean, like, that's great.
People were so mean to the president.
Yeah. All they're doing now is evading. They're just really good at evading questions and, like, just reading office. There's no charm in, like, that. They're just now getting, because the person who's doing it now is also doesn't seem to really know what, there's no, like, spark there.
Right.
There's no, like,
no.
It's just a face on TV talking.
Well, they need like someone to be, like, in the dunk tank, you know?
Yeah, and that's what it seems like. And they're like, oh, this is like a nice person. This looks like what a nice person would look like. And
go out there, get beat up for like 20 minutes, and come back.
Yeah, go be mean. Like, they're essentially kind of mean too, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you had me out there saying what they said, I'd be fucking
fired.
You would
be the best press secretary.
We
should try to get.
But I wouldn't last. Like, I get halfway through the meeting, and I'm like, all right, this guy.
You'd be like, shut the fuck up.
Which is essentially what these people are saying.
Yeah.
But in a very, like, condescending way, which infuriates me because I know what they're doing.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. So we were talking about art and politics and like your evolution or whatever through your art practice. What do you think now, like given the lay of the land, you know, Donald Trump being the president, the genocide in Palestine unthwarted or like seemingly the public's attention like distracted?
Or... Well, the journalists are gone. Everyone who's talking is gone. Anyway, yeah. All right.
What do you see as like your focus or your like role insofar as politics is concerned?
I don't honestly, in like the words of like June Jordan, it's just like to be a menace. Mm-hmm. To just remind, like, you know, like keep talking about it.
Yeah.
Like that's, it seems like all I can, you know what I mean? And then like support boycott movements or like donate where I can. And like, you know, unfortunately I've like taken myself out of the game of like tying myself to like the fucking arms manufacturer Gates and shit like that. But like,
yeah,
I think that's it at that point. 'Cause right now it does feel like a deflation in the movement, you know?
Yeah.
Especially with the win from Zohran. I feel like people are like, that win kind of really like quieted a lot of people down.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, we're still in the same thing. The movement, I mean, the fucking Zionist movement is still on their agenda.
Yeah.
Unstopped. You know, and unfortunately there's like things that happen that make it easier for Zionists to be like, you see, this is what's happening in the name of like the globalized, the Intifada movement or whatever that is. So, I don't know if my mission's more than just like being truthful to myself and everyone around and making sure everyone in my family knows what's up. My daughter grows up, my son grows up knowing the truth and like that kind of shit. But
yeah.
Like I don't know. I don't know.
But what about,
I mean, I do think we're closer to a non-Zionist president than ever.
Right.
Like maybe within my lifetime we'll get that.
Yeah.
But I got to tell you, like, it's the writing's on the wall for how like destructive like Israel is being, like, you know, like, and how far they're willing to take it to like push it before it's too late.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that there's like ebbs and flows of like brutality and the public's attention on that brutality.
But my fear is there's no longer room for like a pullback. It's like all eyes are on now.
Yeah.
There's suppression in the media, but like, if they don't finish their mission soon, then like, it's no longer like, you know what I mean? Like, that's what scares me is that like, okay, and they're just going to get away. Like, this is the most insane shit we've seen for 2 years.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, they've been allowed to pretty much do it. Like pretty much allowed to, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Encouraged.
Encouraged even.
Aided.
Yeah.
But I guess what I meant was like, how do you see yourself relating to politics when it comes to like, you know,
right,
Donald Trump, the Democratic Party, Zohran Mamdani,
I guess it's
the DSA.
Not,
I don't know.
I don't see it as my. I those are one of the things where I'm just going to see what's pitched at me, and I'm going to swing if I want to swing, and if I'm not going to swing, I'm not going to swing.
Yeah,
like the Zohran thing. I do think deep down he is. I do think not even deep down. I think he's an anti-Zionist. Mm-hmm. You know, for as much as he can say it out loud. Now, we've talked about this where there's an agenda that he's trying to push.
Sure, yeah.
And I don't necessarily think that the mayor of New York City needs to be the leader of the Palestinian freedom movement.
Yeah.
Because I don't think that's it. It would be great if he was up there speaking the truth to power without having to be like, I do want Hakeem, like through his teeth lying, I want Hakeem Jeffries to be not, you know, with the leader of the fucking house. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or keeping Tish. I mean, that the Tish thing to me was super discouraging.
Yeah.
In terms of just like, do we have to pick that one? Like, I know you're not going to find a, like an anti-Zionist fucking police chief.
Yeah.
But like that one.
I don't know if he picked that, you know.
But that's what I'm saying.
Like, I wonder if Hochul was like, listen.
100%. But that's discouraging to people because it.
Yeah.
Like deep down, you see this person who's like, you know, is like good.
Yeah.
And is for the cause and has been doing stuff from before he was trying to step in the spotlight of becoming like a mayor. Like, I don't think he took on the Palestinian cause because he thought it would help him win.
No.
You know, like, if anything, I think he was shooting himself in the foot every time he took a step up knowing what he did. But like, that's the discouraging part is that like, because I want cheap housing here, I kind of have to sell out some of my beliefs in Palestine. Where
do
I'm gonna
see, you see it that way?
Well, kind. I mean, like, I can't. I don't feel comfortably like speaking up on like how great I think Zoran is when he's like appointing fucking Tish. Mm-hmm. Where he like I've been affected by Tish, like being out on the protest line and like getting like harassed by cops and stuff.
Same here. I was at Columbia University the night they sent the cops in there, but like, I've made the argument to you. You know, obviously, like off mic or whatever, that, yeah, like he's making, I think, right? I have no like insider info, but it would seem that he's making deals like behind closed doors to have a sufficient coalition to push through the affordability stuff. I hope that's true. You know?
I think it is. I think it. I mean, yeah, but I don't know.
But that doesn't. You don't find that like you're not going to go out and make that argument.
I think
like to like other Palestine movement people and say,
no, I'm never going to tell anyone how to vote on this at all. Like,
yeah,
I know. Like, there's two of me, right? There's like the local voter where I'm like, okay, yeah, I need cheap rent. I want. Also, none of this stuff even affects me anymore because my kid's older. I'm not in rent.
Well,
you know, but I'm saying,
yeah.
Anyway, I'm just saying for the betterment of the city that I love, I do think that I'm glad I voted. Technically, I had Rami fill in the bubble, so I didn't really vote. But but I think that there is an adult like.
But
maybe
you're just saying you had a 6-year-old vote. That's
voter fraud.
Cheap people doing voter fraud.
I think there's a prag. I think maybe I'm getting older, or maybe because it affects me more here. There was a pragmatic view on this election.
Yeah.
That I don't hold to the national, like the president or the senators. Like, I don't. Like, if you aren't saying, I want a free pass, like, I think at the very least what Zoran said, where it's like a fucking country where everyone was equal.
Yeah.
And you're not taking AIPAC money, I don't see a vote coming in for me at all.
No, right.
At the very least, like, no AIPAC money.
Yeah.
You know? And then with like Newsom being like, AIPAC money? I don't even know what AIPAC. What's AIPAC? Like, what, dog? I know JPAC. I'm like, okay, dude. Like, what are you like? Also, we all know now, you know?
Yeah.
Everybody knows too much. But so, does that answer your question?
Yeah. I mean,
like, it's hard. It's hard because deep down, you know that this person's probably like on your side, but there are deals. And that's the nasty part.
I guess, like, where I stand, and I'm curious your thoughts about this, it's like, he doesn't. Besides, well, okay, this might be a good thing to end it on. Benjamin Netanyahu is coming to Washington, D.C. on the end of December. Netanyahu's landing in D.C.
Yeah.
I saw an email at my job that said that he's not planning on going back to Israel until January 4th.
Of course.
And Zoran's inauguration is on the 1st.
Of course. His ass is going to be here first day.
At the inauguration.
100%. Front row.
So, like, I mean, I guess what I was going to say is I hope that what Zoran is trading is just, like, public statements that don't really have any real, like, real-world manifestations, right? Like, if he says, I condemn the phrase globalize the intifada, in theory, there's no real material consequence to that. It's ugly if you are from the Palestine movement to hear that. If you supported him, it's like ugly to hear that, right?
Yes.
But he does have the ability to deliver actual like material things.
But I think the thing is like, why can't he do both? Like, why does he have to sell out knowing what globalized the intifada means?
Yeah.
Instead of diminishing that and making the people who use that as like what for the truth of what it is.
Yeah.
Why can't he do that and deliver? Like to say that you can't say you believe in the like the globalization of the intifada or whatever that means.
Yeah,
essentially,
yeah.
Like, you know,
river
what I mean?
To the sea, whatever.
Whatever.
Yeah,
and still be a good mayor and serve your fucking.
Yeah, I mean, I
countrymen.
Guess the short like, answer is because he can't do those things without
sure
the coalition that includes a bunch of centrists and Zionists.
Yes.
And so, if he doesn't show them he's willing to sort of like concede some of these things to get those material deliverables for the people, then he won't get them in theory. I think that's his calculation. But the real interesting test is going to, I mean, the first one is going to be so fucking.
No, it's
going to
be a punch move where fucking Netanyahu is going to show up fucking first day. Probably try to get into the fucking inauguration. But I think the way Zoran, whether he gets him kicked out or not, doesn't really matter. But it's like, there's a lot of these like there's a lot of symbolism in American politics.
Yeah.
So him saying, I don't support saying globalized intifada, or I've never said it, fine. Okay, but that symbolizes that you've now like demonized or you've validated the feelings of what that is in the eyes of other people, knowing what the truth of that thing is. Mm-hmm. If he shows up, he's like, I'm doing my best. I don't even know if he can get him arrested, right? Like, I don't even know if he can.
I don't know either.
Yeah, so let's say, but even if he, Netanyahu comes and he's like, and Zoran Smigs is like, yeah, I'm trying my best to get this guy arrested, and he like shows.
Can you just imagine him being like, Tish? He calls right. Tish. Hey, I was just inaugurated half hour ago. Yeah. I need you to
arrest Netanyahu.
Go arrest the fucking.
She's like,
police.
Oh yeah, I think I know what hotel he's staying at. My parents' fucking hotel fucking building. Like, that's
with,
my point.
I'm with him right now.
Yeah. Oh shit. Yo, BB.
Throw your hands behind.
Zoran wants you to leave.
Nah, dude, he's not. Nah, he's not stoked, dog. Nah.
Oh, dude, I knew you were gonna call. Yeah, no, he's here right now.
Kick out.
Yo, it's like not chill. You're here, actually, dude.
We think it's not chill, and we think you should probably fucking leave right now.
Yeah. I don't know, but I mean, he's getting. I mean, that's the thing. But he sticks to his point, dude. And he's got better politics than Bernie. He's got, listen, for whatever. He's got the best politics of any. Maybe not any politician. There's probably some good ones in like Seattle that run like a fucking little town. But like Zoran, I think, has one of the most like the best politician in my time right now. Like you know what I mean? Like American politician.
In terms of where he stands on shit, yeah. But I'll tell you, as someone who follows Latin American politics closely, I see, for example, politicians like Lula, who, in my opinion, is like the greatest politician of my lifetime, who was able to, like, in his first term. I think he was a much better president in his first term than in his...
But just real quick.
Yeah.
Like, Brazilian politics is way different than... Like, they arrested Bolsonaro.
And Lula. Lula was in prison.
Okay, see, I mean, they're putting... There's people we're different systems. Different. Anyway, but go ahead.
It's different, but it's completely different. But I guess my point is this. Lula, who's like a labor organizer, ran for president a bunch of times, didn't get elected, eventually did get elected, and was able to put together a broad enough coalition that included a bunch of business interests and a bunch of wealthy people and the labor unions that he used to organize for and the Workers' Party and all these sort of different factions to deliver things that brought tens of millions of people out of poverty, built hospitals, built universities. There used to be a lot of people in Brazil, like when before Lula was president the first time, who were literally dying of hunger.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of like put an end to that in for the vast majority of the country. And then he was put in prison, and then he, I mean, that's like a Hollywood movie. He came out of prison because the court had to overturn his conviction because there was the prosecution of the case was completely corrupt. And now he's president again, and yeah, maybe his current term isn't as successful, but when you look at his accomplishments in his first term, you got to like see how building these coalitions and working with people who think differently than him allowed him to deliver some pretty left-wing populist policies that changed the lives of tens of millions of people. Then you got people like, let's say, Gabriel Boric, the current president of Chile. They just lost, like, his political faction. The left just lost this election in Chile.
Okay.
And the guy who's going to be the president now is a fascist. Like, he comes from, like, I think his father or his grandfather was, like, literally a Nazi who, like, moved to Chile after the war. He was, like, I think an official in the Pinochet government, or at least he worked on the campaign to keep Pinochet in power, like, in the late 80s. He's a bad guy. And part of the reason why he won that election was because Boric, who, when he won, I like agreed with so many of the things he said and stood for, completely failed. Like, his government was just complete failure to deliver any of the things he promised. And there was like all this dysfunction because I think that they didn't really know how to like govern. They didn't know how to come in and deliver, you know? And so when I look at Zoran, I'm like, I hope he ends up being a Lula and not a Boric.
You know, I said he's the best of my time. I think he's the most earnest, and I genuinely think he wants to do good.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think he's, and the ego isn't there with him, it doesn't seem like.
Yeah.
And he also isn't even fucking married yet, but like, I do have high hopes. I'm optimistic about him. I don't know how much can be changed, but I do think he's going to be in there, like, trying his best. Because he's got, like, I don't know.
Is there anything else we should talk about?
I don't think so. Do you not have anything else?
I got nothing else. I have a couple other things we didn't get to, but I think we can get
to more New Yorker stuff?
No. More art stuff.
Oh. No, we don't have to talk about that. No, but this is good.
All right. Well, thanks for talking to me. Thanks for listening, if you're one of the people listening to this.
Thanks for having me. This was fun. Thanks, Russ.
I love you.
I love you.
And I love everyone else listening to this so much.
He means it.
I really mean it, too. I want to some boy and them little jump on sound.